told Mr. Sabato on the way in that it cost the Miller Center a good deal to turn out this crowd. But with hard work, we managed to do it. There are at least three things that are unique about this discussion. One is the mean age of the participants, even including Professor Mosier and myself, is somewhat below the age of most of our panel discussions. And that's the way it should be. Miller Center, if it has one or two major goals, one of them is that it in some way connect in with the emergence of leading figures who 10, 20 years from now will, if not already, will stand out as foremost figures in their field. Another thing unique about it is that the presence of two of our participants suggests that the University of Virginia is coming of age. Harvard quite frequently appoints its own. Virginia is a little tardy sometimes in appointing those who have been associated with it. And the third is that we welcome an opportunity to have discussion on a topic that is of intense interest and concern to all of you, which is difficult to assess and appraise at any moment during the electoral process, but which our speaker today has, in his writings and in his work, has shown himself uniquely qualified to do. There is another side of our speaker. Yesterday we had a German political scientist here, and he mentioned two books. One, the book The Party is Over, David Broder's account of the decline of political parties, and the other, Larry Sabato's book, pronounced in German, Sabato, The Party's Just Begun. That book and a flood of others reflect the intellectual versatility and the productivity of Larry Sabato, something that would surprise none of his undergraduate teachers or professors that knew him as a young student, even prior to his Rhodes Scholarship days. This flood of books includes such things as PAC Power, Inside the World of Political Action Committees, The Rise of Political Consultants, New Ways of Winning Elections, Goodbye to Good Time Charlie, The Transformation of the Office of Governor, and a host of other writings that have established him as a major figure in American government. The two commentators that will begin our discussion, David Clinton, who is a scholar in residence. David, incidentally, was Larry Sabato's first teaching assistant in American government. However, he saw the error of his ways and shifted to international relations and has already begun to establish an enviable record in this field with major writings on such important topics as the national interest. Frederick Mosier will be the second commentator or questioner recruited en route to this table. He needs no introduction to any group who knows anything about the development of political science in this country. He stands out as one of the most eminent figures in the field. And among his other accomplishments, he survived a period of landlordship of Larry Sabato. So there are certain things he knows and can question, which none of the rest of us can question. It's a great honor to have Larry with us. Talk about the election.
Ken, thank you so much for that generous introduction, and I'm certainly pleased to see so many friends here and colleagues and so on, and certainly to see David again, but particularly to have Fritz. here as one of my questioners, though it does worry me a little bit, because I can tell you many an evening during my first year back here at the university was spent upstairs arguing with Fritz about politics. So I'm a little concerned, and he knows a little too much about me, but I hope he'll be a little discreet. Today, but
I'm always discreet.
Oh. As I said, I hope they'll be a little discreet. But in any event, I can only assume that most people have heard my slogan, other than politics is a good thing, which is that he who lives by the crystal ball ends up eating ground glass. I regularly have a meal of ground glass on the day after the election, and I depend on people not remembering what I said prior to the election, after the election is over with. So I would request today that people erase their memories of what I do say about the election as soon as they leave here, so I can't be held accountable once the votes actually come in. I'm just going to talk for a few minutes about the elections and then take questions, because I know many of you are vitally interested in the elections or even involved in one of the campaigns, and I think the discussion is always more interesting than the monologue anyway. I start out from a premise that isn't widely shared in the news media, I think, and that simply is that while I'll grant you we have two dull presidential nominees, I think we have two outstanding presidential nominees. And I'm convinced, or I think you can make a strong case, that either George Bush or Michael Dukakis is better prepared and would make a more competent president than either of their two predecessors, one a Republican and one a Democrat. So I don't take the cynical view that is bandied about these days, that these nominees are leftover remainder candidates and not likely to do a good job. I reject the cynicism that I see so frequently in news media reports, particularly national television media. That's what I'm focusing on here. I remember one reporter ended her remarks not too long ago on one of the national nightly news broadcasts by saying that the choice of a president this year was going to be much like the selection of a new refrigerator. Everyone needed one, but it wouldn't be a whole lot of fun. And I don't believe that's true. In fact, I think we're going to have an exciting election and an election that's well worth listening to. Now, I'll grant you there will be low points. We're probably in one right now. But I think it's going to be a good election. I suppose in starting out my comments, I should note that, and I don't want this repeated because it would destroy my business as an election analyst, I think we tend to overanalyze elections. There's often much less there than meets the eyes, at least in terms of how the voters react to candidates and to political issues. In my opinion, vague feelings tend to drive elections, mainly because voters don't pay close attention to elections. They don't follow the issues. They don't follow the candidates very closely. So vague feelings drive elections, and one of the vaguest of those feelings, and yet one of the most powerful in American history, has been the notion that it's time for a change. And the cycle of change normally occurs in an 8-year cycle in American presidential politics. There are always exceptions, and events and circumstance produce exceptions, but by and large, there's an 8-year cycle of change. And of course, we're finishing an 8-year cycle of a Republican term. And I think that vague feeling is the underlying force driving much of the commentary about politics today. Natural grievances accumulate over an 8-year term, and those natural grievances tend to produce change at the end of that 8-year cycle. Obviously, there are some very important points to be made in George Bush's behalf. That is, the economy is very good, and by and large, there's peace in the world, and so on and so forth. And yet, historically, when the economy has been going great guns and an incumbent has not been running, the candidate of the president's party does not necessarily benefit from that strong economy. An incumbent benefits from a strong economy, but not a non-incumbent of the president's party. So the fact that the economy is going great guns may very well just shift the focus of the election to other issues, and issues that do not favor George Bush. Similarly, Republican candidates, you could argue, do better at times of international stress and turmoil rather than peace. The summit and the new relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union has moved the campaign agenda away from foreign policy to a certain degree. And of course, it's in the area of foreign policy that George Bush has his greatest advantage over Michael Dukakis. So the election is shifting to issues, or has shifted so far at least, to issues that would benefit Dukakis rather than Bush. We shouldn't rely on the early polls. The early polls, as I'm sure all of you know, are next to worthless. I don't know why we put so much emphasis on those early polls. They're going to bounce all over the sky. In the last several presidential elections, voters, or the swing voters, the independent group of swing voters, have been making up their minds later and later in the campaign process. Some studies in 1980, for example, showed that up to a quarter of the voters either switched their choice or made up their mind in the last 72 hours before the voting on election day. There was one election exit poll on election day, incredibly enough, that showed that 10% of the people were unsure, had not made up their minds firmly about their presidential choice while standing in line at the polls. You know, so we often assume that these choices are carved into stone. And in fact, they're much more like a sandcastle. And one strong wave can sweep that castle away or change the contours of the beach. So the early polls, I think, are next to worthless. So too are the election theories that purport to claim that the election is over before it begins. And I refer most particularly to Horace Busby's electoral lock theory that he's been selling for a number of years and done very well with. It's made him a tidy fortune. This electoral lock theory holds that Republicans have a lock on the Electoral College, that even in years when Democrats do relatively well in the popular vote, the Electoral College will ensure a Republican victory because the Republicans have secured the South, they've secured the Rocky Mountain states, they secured California, which of course is totally untrue, and so on. Already in this election, we're seeing that the electoral lock theory bears no relationship to reality. And I suspect that on election day, you're going to find that the Electoral College pattern in 1988 really does not resemble in some major ways the Electoral College pattern of 1980 and 1984. Iowa, for example, which has traditionally been a very reliable Republican state, I think is very likely to vote Democratic this year. There are some of the tier Rocky Mountain states that may not vote Republican this year. Obviously, Texas is a good example of a toss-up state, a southern slash western state that may very likely vote Democratic this year. I suspect Texas will go the way of the winner in the end, and it's going to be close. The Benson choice moved it out of the safe Bush category into the toss-up category. And some of the border states that have traditionally voted Republican, at least in the post-Nixon era, may very well vote Democratic this year. So I tend to reject these theories that suggest that our electoral system is carved in stone, because it isn't. Real circumstances, real personalities, real issues, the changing forces in each election year can completely change the electoral map. And I believe we really are going to see this in 1988. So in any event, I think the underlying trend of election year 1988 is a pro-democratic trend. You can see this not simply because of the time for a change theme, but you can see it at the local level and at the other electoral levels. In the United States Senate, for example, the Democrats have virtually no chance of losing their majority. At most, I think they'll lose two seats out of their current majority. The likelihood is that they're going to increase their Senate majority. The likelihood is they will add at least one seat and possibly two to their Senate majority. And looking state by state and judging the races, this is what most of us come up with. In the House of Representatives, there will be very, very little change, as unfortunately there traditionally is. As you know, in 1986, 98% of all incumbent U.S. House members who sought another term were in fact reelected. Since World War II, the average has been 92%, and that includes such bad years for incumbents as 1964 for Republican incumbents and 1974 for Republican incumbents and 1980 for Democratic incumbents. And despite those bad years, when you average it all out, 92% of all incumbent U.S. House members have been reelected. I suspect that we'll be closer to the 98% than the 92% in 1988. So there's going to be very little change there. But so far, in analyzing individual races, there is a slight trend to the Democrats. Right now, the guess would be that Democrats would pick up 5 to 10 seats in the lower house as well. In governorships, there are only a few governorships up, really a baker's dozen in 1988. Most of the governors are elected in the off years. But just with that very limited number, the projection now is that Democrats will pick up at least one or two governorships. In the state legislatures, the projection is that Democrats will pick up several houses, both Senates and Houses of Representatives. So clearly, from top to bottom, we can detect a slight Democratic trend. It isn't a landslide Democratic trend, but it's a slight Democratic trend. So that suggests to me that George Bush has to run a very good campaign, a very positive campaign, a campaign that is relatively error-free in order to win, because he's swimming upstream. He's swimming against that slight Democratic tide that we can detect in 1988. Does that mean that it's impossible for George Bush to win? Of course not. The presidential election is our most personalized election. It's the election where party labels probably matter least and where personalities probably matter most. American voters will gain a great deal of information about Dukakis and Bush, as opposed to the little information they'll have about the issues or candidates for lower office. My favorite example of public ignorance is not the recent geography study. It's from 1978, when the SALT II treaties were being considered. You may remember this because it was a major controversy at the time. The fact that different polls were taken in a given week, and some of them would show people strongly favoring the SALT II treaties, and other polls would show people were strongly against the SALT II treaties, and no one could figure out why there was this tremendous swing in public opinion, until one pollster working for the New York Times had the good sense to ask a very basic question before he asked, "Do you favor or oppose the treaty?" And the question he asked was, "Which are the two countries involved in the SALT II negotiations?" And you won't believe this, but it's true. 77% of the random sample of the American population could not name the United States and Russia. Now, if you don't know that the U.S. and Russia are the two countries involved in the SALT II negotiations, obviously you're not going to have a very well-informed view of the SALT II treaties, and therefore the wording of the question could kick 20% in one direction or the other. And I'm afraid that that is not completely unrepresentative of how the American public views campaign issues, even in a presidential year. So in any event, given the fact that the presidency is our most personalized office, George Bush has a chance to win despite the fact that there is that slight Democratic trend, because party labels won't matter as much as personalities. He also has a chance to win because of some other factors. And one is, in fact, personality. George Bush has, I think, had a bad rap to a certain degree on his personality. He's gotten the label of wimp. He's gotten the label of not being a strong, decisive character, and so on. And there may be some truth, at least to the latter the latter a characteristic, but just about everybody who knows George Bush well on a personal level says that, in fact, he's a very kind individual, a very nice person. He comes across well one-on-one. I think he's going to wear relatively well during the campaign if he doesn't listen too closely to the campaign advisors telling him to go on the attack, to use the harsh negative attack mode. I don't think he comes across well in that situation. Michael Dukakis, by contrast, gives the impression of being competent, which he certainly is, but he also has a touch of arrogance about him that I don't think will wear well if, in fact, he allows people to see that side of him. One person in Massachusetts who had worked closely with Dukakis over the years, in his years as governor, who supported Dukakis, by the way, put it this way. You know, whatever subject I'm discussing with Michael Dukakis, he knows more about it than I do. It's that kind of smart alecky, know-it-all arrogance that I think won't wear well over the campaign if people actually see it. Believe it or not, it's easier to enclose a presidential candidate in a cocoon, in a staff cocoon, than it is to do so to a Senate candidate or a House candidate. Now, a Senate or House candidate doesn't have nearly as many press people following him or her. A presidential candidate has enormous numbers of press people, but they also have many more staff people. They also have many more security people. It's easier to keep them hidden, to keep their real characteristics hidden during a campaign. It's only during their presidency that we find out what they're really like. So I think Bush may have a slight advantage on the personality score. And then there's some very good issues that Bush can use against Dukakis. We've all heard already of the furlough issue, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that. I've seen the scripts. I haven't seen the TV ads, but I've seen the scripts of a couple of the proposed TV ads that the Bush people are going to be airing about the furlough issue, and they're going to be pretty hot, as you can well imagine. They're going to be focusing on Willie Horton, the man who was released on the weekend furlough in Massachusetts under the Dukakis furlough program, who didn't return to prison on Monday and instead made his way to Maryland and, in fact, was involved in a brutal rape before he was recaptured, and so on. And there are some other characters that you'll be hearing a great deal about. You may be hearing more about Willie Horton than Ollie North during this presidential campaign. And then there's capital punishment. George Bush strongly supports capital punishment for a wide range of crimes. Dukakis opposes all capital punishment. And as the Bush people are going to say, even for terrorists, even for mass murderers, and so on and so forth. So you can see how that issue is going to play. And there's another issue they're planning on harping on, and that's Dukakis' plan for reducing the budget deficit. He's going to hire more IRS agents to collect more taxes that aren't being paid. The Bush people have a theory about this. Their theory, and I think it's reasonably accurate, is that most people, fortunately, are pretty honest in paying their taxes. But the surveys bear this out. They cheat a little bit. They don't cheat much, but they edge here and there. And one of the average American's greatest fears is being called for an IRS audit. And so when they're considering Michael Dukakis' plan to hire many more IRS audits, they might wonder whether, in fact, that little edging that they did last April may not show up in an IRS audit if there are more auditors around to take care of them. So they're planning on playing on the public fear on the IRS question as well. Now, the Bush people are also convinced that Bush is on the side of the angels on the tax issue. I disagree strongly with them. As you know, George Bush has said, "I will not raise taxes under any circumstances." Now, you would think, as the Bush people probably do, that that would play very well. That would be a very popular position to take on the taxing issue. The surprising thing is that it's not the most popular position to take on the taxing issue. Let me show you an example. This is a poll that I conducted myself. And this, we were questioning a random sample. Now let me read you some things you might find out about a candidate for the United States Senate. This could apply equally to a presidential candidate. I'd like you to tell me whether you'd be more or less likely to support a candidate who took the following positions. What if a candidate says he will not raise your taxes under any conditions? That's the Bush position. Well, 26% would be more likely to vote for a candidate who took that position, but 60% would be less likely to vote for a candidate who took that position. Now, why? Well, we went back and probed. We asked people why, because it was mildly surprising. First, they said it wasn't credible. They didn't believe any candidate who said that, and it caused them to question the credibility generally of the candidate who made a flat-out position like that. And second, I thought this was interesting. Many respondents felt that it was irresponsible. As some of them said, well, we don't know what the future holds. There could be a war. There could be a depression. And so on. You can't make a flat-out promise like that that you can absolutely guarantee that you can keep. So sometimes positions that seem popular, in fact, are not. And I think that one may backfire on the Bush campaign if they push it in the wrong way. Well, the key question that I have about the campaign is who is really going to get to define Michael Dukakis? Dukakis made a great leap forward during the Democratic convention in defining himself, and the definition was a highly positive one, as you might suspect, and that was reflected in those bump-up polls taken right after the convention. Bush, during his convention and his convention speakers, attempted to define Dukakis their own way, as a far-out liberal, representative of McGovernism and Mondaleism in the Democratic Party, and so on and so forth. The question is, which definition of Dukakis will actually take in the American public? Which definition will be the one that people believe? Well, I think that Dukakis has an advantage here for one major reason. Dukakis wasn't first defined by Dukakis at the Democratic convention, and he was not first defined by Bush at the Republican convention. He was first defined by Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson did Michael Dukakis an enormous favor. He took a very liberal governor of Massachusetts, who on the basis of his defense policies, for example, was actually to the left of the positions George McGovern took in 1972. And he took this very liberal governor of Massachusetts and he transformed him almost overnight into a centrist. Because after Illinois and Michigan and Wisconsin, there were really only two candidates in the race, Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson. And those average American voters who remember are not paying close attention to politics knew one thing about Jesse Jackson. He was the leftist candidate, in addition to being the black candidate for president. And there was this other fellow running against him. And by implication, he must be a moderate. And this was shown again and again in the primary exit polls. So Jesse Jackson, week after week, contest after contest, reinforced that view, that impression of Michael Dukakis. And he made Michael Dukakis into a centrist. It's much easier to define a candidate for the first time than to redefine a candidate later. And that is the challenge that George Bush faces. He has to redefine Michael Dukakis. And I think that's why, that's another reason why he's got a very difficult task in front of him. One thing is for sure, George Bush has to redefine Michael Dukakis himself, and he has to win the election himself. Ronald Reagan isn't going to do it for him. Ronald Reagan can stir up the enthusiasm of the Republican troops, and he can certainly raise money, but he can't transfer popularity. And he proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt in the Senate contest in 1986. So George Bush has to win it himself. Let me say a word or two about the vice presidential choices before I conclude, since that's been the focus of attention in the past few days. In retrospect, Dukakis's choice of Benson appears even better than it did at the time, as you can see. Though I personally felt and still feel that John Glenn would have been a stronger candidate simply because he guaranteed a toss-up state to Michael Dukakis. John Glenn's popularity in Ohio is such that he would have automatically moved Ohio's electoral votes into the Dukakis column. All Lloyd Benson has done is to move Texas into the toss-up category. And I just can't tell you, no one can tell you today whether it will work or not. The polls that I've seen have Dukakis ahead by a few points. One poll has Bush ahead by a few points. In the end, unless this election breaks strongly to Dukakis, and it might, you never know what the debates are going to bring and so on. If it breaks strongly to Dukakis, I think Texas will fall into Dukakis' column. But if this is a very close election, it seems to me that Bush's argument that Texans would rather have a president than a vice president will take hold. And Texans who feel guilty about not voting for Lloyd Benson will be able to vote for him anyway and re-elect him to the United States Senate. So I tend to think that psychology is going to take hold if this is a very close election and if it doesn't break strongly to Dukakis. Also, imagine if John Glenn had been the vice presidential nominee when the Quayle controversy broke. Now, it's true that Benson served in World War II and so on, but John Glenn is a class, it's a grade A, class number one national hero. And I think the contrast between Glenn and Quayle would have been even starker than it has been between Quayle and Benson. So maybe I'm just trying to justify my own preference or my belief that Glenn would have done more for Dukakis than Benson has done or will do, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, Benson was at least a good choice, if not the best available choice. Why in the world did George Bush pick Dan Quayle? I think that's the real question on the minds of just about all Americans. And yes, the Bush people are correct to say that there's been a feeding frenzy by the press about the Quayle issue. There always is when a controversy of this sort arises, because the media people are competitive. They're competing with one another to get a good story. They want to break the story first and so on and so forth. Let me explain one thing, though, and I think this is true based on my own experience with the press. I found that when something that may appear to be relatively minor becomes a major controversy, it happens not because the issue itself is of monumental importance. It's because the press uses that issue as a cover story for an underlying premise that they think is particularly important. The underlying premise about Dan Quayle is that virtually no one, and I mean no one, even in the Bush inner circle, contends that Dan Quayle is the most qualified Republican to become president if anything happened to George Bush. The underlying premise is that Dan Quayle is untested, is unpresidential, and is a lightweight. That's the underlying premise. I was on the floor of the Republican convention when the news about Quayle broke. And I can tell you that the Republican delegates and even some Republican office holders on the floor were shaking their heads in disbelief. They just couldn't believe it. I had three senators, of course, off the record, because they've never put this off the record, and part of it may have been jealousy, I'll grant you, because they weren't selected and Quayle was. But these senators said some very unkind things about Dan Quayle, not about his viewpoints, not about his beliefs, but about his mental capacity, his abilities, and his readiness to become president if the circumstances required it. All the reporters at the convention heard these questions about Quayle. All of them who knew Dan Quayle couldn't believe that he'd been selected either. They knew why he had been selected, at least superficially. George Bush wanted a George Bush. He wanted someone who was going to be as loyal to him as he had been to Ronald Reagan. He wanted someone who was going to be unquestioning, and also someone who did not have an independent power base. That's why he really tilted against Jack Kemp and Bob Dole. Both of them have independent power bases. Both of them have very strong wills and are outspoken. Neither one of them could be guaranteed to back George Bush in all circumstances during his White House years, if in fact he was elected. He looked at the comfortability factor, and that became the decisive one for him in the group of candidates that he had. So he eliminated Kemp and Dole on that basis. Why did he select Dan Quayle? There were many possibilities, many, many other people. He saw Dan Quayle as solving his conservative problem, because Dan Quayle is one of the golden boys of the conservative movement. He didn't want any unpleasant incidents at the convention, and already Gordon Humphrey, the very conservative senator from New Hampshire, was threatening to nominate someone from the floor if George Bush didn't pick a conservative. He didn't want that kind of distraction on national television. Secondly, he knew that his basic problem with the electorate, or one of his basic problems with the electorate, was with women. He had an enormous gender gap, one of the largest ever recorded, in fact, the largest in presidential politics, and one of the largest recorded at any electoral level. So he didn't want to pick a woman because he felt that his choice would be interpreted as tokenism, much as Ferraro's choice by Mondale was interpreted as tokenism in 1984. So he, and some of the Bush people, they won't say this on the record, but the truth is that they view Quayle's Robert Redford good looks as a sop to women. And of course, intelligent thinking women are offended by that description, but I merely point out to you that it's worked precisely that way in Indiana. Maybe not all women, is not all men focus on the issues, and some of them focus on looks and personalities, and in the television age, looks really matter. I was amused by the criticism I heard about this issue from many of the national television people and anchor people. You know, they were shocked to find that looks would be a qualification for being hired for a job. So it was a little hypocritical, but that's a side issue. So he thought that Quayle would help him with at least some women and shave a few points off the gender gap. And finally, he thought that Quayle would enable him to solidify Republican support among the young. The strongest support for Ronald Reagan over the past 8 years has been registered by the 18 to 30 age group. It used to be that Republicans had their strongest support in those over the age of 60, and Democrats had their strongest support in the youngest age group. Now it's exactly the reverse. Democrats have their strongest support in the over 60 age group. The strongest Republican support is registered in that 18 to 30 age cohort. So he wanted to solidify his support with the young, and his polls had shown a dip in support among the baby boomers, among those in their 30s. So he thought that Quayle could make the baby boom connection. So that's really why he picked Dan Quayle. It was a process of elimination, and then the fact that George Bush thought that Quayle would solve some of his electoral problems. Well, my impression, I think the impression of even most Republicans at the National Convention, was that Quayle was a bad choice for Bush even before the controversy about the National Guard was revealed. You know, he was opposed strongly by Lee Atwater, effective campaign manager, and Jim Baker, the overall campaign manager of the Bush effort. Both of them tried to talk Bush out of Quayle and were unsuccessful in doing so. The reason just about everybody felt Quayle was a bad choice was because, number one, he brings not a single electoral vote to Bush that Bush didn't already have. If Indiana doesn't go Republican, you know, it's an election night where we can all go to bed by 9 o'clock, you know, because there's no contest. Quayle has no name recognition and no visible support outside Indiana. They claim he's going to help in the Midwest. I haven't seen it, and I've been talking to people from the Midwest at the convention. They didn't see it. Also, Baker and Atwater knew what others knew, which is that Dan Quayle was an untested candidate. He had not been subjected to the scrutiny that a national candidate has to be subjected to in the course of a national campaign. They feared, without knowing, really, that there was something there that would come out and embarrass the campaign and take the attention away from Bush at his most crucial moment. They also knew Quayle well enough to know that he was somewhat immature. He doesn't come across as being presidential. He would not be interpreted by the press or probably by the voters as being someone who was able to step into Bush's shoes if something happened to Bush. So they simply rejected those arguments, but Bush made his own choice. I think that Quayle, even though the Quayle controversy about the National Guard will die down, I think inevitably it will, because the Bush people have decided to tough it out, to keep Quayle on the ticket, because they have to. If they drop Quayle, it might very well be a fatal blow to Bush's candidacy. So they know they have to keep him on the ticket. They've decided to tough it out. They're doing it in two ways. And by the way, they decided these two ways on Thursday evening at the convention. They met right after Bush and Quayle waved from the podium. And they decided to turn the issue around, make it an issue of patriotism, which is why the last few days they've been stressing those patriotism issues. They're trying to say that the Democrats are saying that anyone who has served in the National Guard is unpatriotic. And they decided to turn it on the press to try and divert public anger to the press. And that's why you saw that set-up press conference on Friday in Quayle's hometown. Of course, they claimed that it wasn't a setup. It was a setup. I can tell you for sure because one of the staff members told me what they were going to try to do. Not necessarily in his hometown, but they knew Thursday night what they were going to do. And they were going to turn this on the press, and they managed to do it in Quayle's hometown. Quayle, even though this problem will fade, I think he's going to be a burden for Bush between now and the election in some fashion or another, only because of the context. He'll take some of the focus off the message that George Bush wants to communicate. And I think the best thing the Bush campaign can do is to do what the Nixon campaign did with Spiro Agnew in 1968 after Agnew became a burden. You remember all the Fat Jack comments and so on and so forth during the 68 campaign. They sent Spiro Agnew into every small town in America. They basically helped him to fade from the front pages by making him relatively inaccessible and by simply pushing him into the background of the campaign. So I think that's the best thing the Bush can do at this point. I don't want to conclude this discussion of Quayle without making the point that I think needs to be made and that hasn't been made by the national press. I'm particularly interested in it because of my study of political consultants. If you want to know who proposed Quayle to Bush, I'll tell you who it was. There were two people. Roger Ailes, who is Bush's television consultant, and Bob Teeter, who is Bush's pollster. These are the two people who first put Dan Quayle on the vice presidential list and who strongly argued his case to Bush. Now, why did they do that? Well, they did it because Ailes and Teeter were Dan Quayle's consultants for his two Senate elections in 1980 and 1986. They knew that he projected a good image, they knew that he was malleable, and they knew that his personality would mesh well with George Bush. And that's why they pushed him. And if you ever want an example of the influence that political consultants have over candidates and with candidates, you can always cite the Quayle example, because even the Bush insiders will tell you, or rather blame, Ailes and Teeter for the choice of Dan Quayle. Well, I think I probably rambled on too long. I had some other subjects to discuss, but I think we can wait for them to come out in the questions or in the very kind comments that I know Fritz Mosier will be making about the presentation.
Fritz doesn't want to be called on. He'll speak only when the spirit moves him.
I promise, Larry, I wouldn't bother him. So.
David, do you want to?
Just one or two things. You began by talking about the underlying factors, the underlying feeling that it's a time for a change, which is a cycle that is present throughout much of American history, goes far beyond this particular election. Then the next level, the condition of the country, which has been produced by decisions that have been taken before the electoral season began, peace and prosperity you talked about. Then the primary season, and you mentioned that Dukakis had been partially defined already before the Democratic Convention by reason of his contest with Jesse Jackson. So all of this had happened before the general election campaign began. And then on the other end, you talked about the swing voters who made up their minds in the last 72 hours of the presidential campaign, or even while they were standing in the voting booth lines. My first question would be, how important, relative to these other things, the broad underlying factors or the last-minute decisions, is what happened in the 10 weeks between now and election day? Is that the most important thing? Is it secondary to one of these? How does that stack up?
Well, it's a good question. It's difficult to rank order them. I think I would say that the early events set up the parameters of the election, the parameters reported by the press and interpreted by voters. So the earlier occurrences that you just recounted determined the basic framework within which the election of 1988 will be contested. And that's very important because the press and voters generally don't normally go outside the basic parameters of the framework of an election to interpret events. So the interpretations will be within that basic framework set before Labor Day. But then the final determination will come on account of the debates and other real and pseudo campaign events that are made into issues during the general election campaign. And it's those real and pseudo events that will determine where the swing voters go, where the independents go, where the upper middle class suburbanites who tend to be very television oriented and very independent tend to go on election day. But remember, those new events, the debate events, the other issues that are developed, will again be interpreted by the press and by political leaders and opinion leaders and communities in terms of the framework that's already been constructed for the presidential campaign prior to Labor Day. So both parts are essential to producing the election result. I really can't say which is more important. I think they're equally important.
Well, that leads to my two other questions, which are related. One is, what is the purpose of the campaign? From the point of view of the candidates, are they trying to project a pleasing personality that will allow people who make up their minds late to decide this is the way I want to go? Is that really what they're trying to do during the next 10 weeks when you say defining their personality or defining themselves before the country? And second, are they better off or not making firm, specific promises during the campaign? You mentioned one example in the case of taxes, which you said is probably not a good idea. Are they better off generally being vague?
Well, it depends on what the specific promise is. If it's something that's achievable and something that is what I call a 90%er, supported by 90% of the people, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or independents, then they're probably better off being specific. I remember Jimmy Carter's 1976 business principles to govern our country. And whenever there's there's a choice to be made between government doing something and business doing something. If it's an equal choice, then I'd go with the business, because I believe in private management working in our free enterprise system. And some people call that conservative. And at the same time, I believe in human beings. That was actually a line in the speech. I believe in human beings. I believe in human rights. Some people call that liberal. So he tried to be very specific while being nonspecific. That's the combination that most candidates prefer. But it's really difficult to answer your question because it depends on what the issue is. Sometimes specifics work and other times they don't. When candidates make specific pledges that they can't back up, they get in trouble. George Bush's recent example of the 30 million jobs may come back to haunt him. You know, his campaign pledged to create 30 million jobs over the course of an 8-year administration, and the Reagan administration's own people in the Labor Department said it couldn't be done unless you imported half of Mexico. It was impossible to do. So there, and they backed away from that. Now they're calling it just a goal, just an indication of the direction in which he wants to move. Then you have Dukakis, on the other hand, being incredibly vague. You know, his campaign line is good jobs at good wages. Well, what does that mean? You know, well, we don't know, but it seems to satisfy most people. I'll just give you one other example. The best illustration of this that I've ever seen, and this really was with a congressional candidate, and I was sitting in the back of the room listening to him, and he was a fairly liberal candidate in a conservative district, and he had positions on some of the issues that just simply wouldn't have gone over in this crowd particularly. And so one voter got up and said, "Now look, what about gun control? What about gun control?" And the candidate got up and said, "Oh, I'm all right on gun control." And do you know that voter said, "Oh, all right." that satisfied him. So it's amazing what candidates can get away with. It really is. And you know, people get mad at the press. They get furious at the press, but let me tell you, when you travel with candidates and see what they get away with, you begin to understand the frustration that builds in the media people, because they can't get answers to their questions, they can't get access to the candidates, and they feel they can't do their job, which is informing people about politics and about what these candidates really stand for. So you have to look at it from their perspective as well.
What about the first part, pleasing personality as an aspect of defining yourself?
Oh, I think that's the whole reason why the first people hired in a campaign are the media consultant and the pollster and the television advisor, who tells them how to look and how to stand and what phrases to use and the nudges to use and the winks to use and so on and so forth. That's in the television age, that's just become supremely important. It's not so much the substance of the issues, it's how you frame the issues in terms of the candidate's persona that really matters.
Are you finished?
I don't think Larry should be allowed to get away with anything, so I think you should.
Oh God.
I knew Larry best when he was still a Democrat.
I am nonpartisan, Fritz.
You know. No, you cross a coin before you go on the booth. I have two questions. I'll put them both. One is that my impression, and this may be a little different from yours, I like your response, is that over the long run, the Democratic candidate doesn't make any difference. My hunch is that Quayle will be forgotten, Benson will be forgotten. or makes, let's say, very little difference. And I wonder if historically, you've studied elections a lot more than I have, do you have any factual evidence that the Vice President made much difference? The second question is this. You mentioned in passing, this is a curious phenomenon. 6 weeks ago, the whole political issue had to do with a guy named Jesse Jackson. I haven't seen Jesse Jackson's name in the paper in the last 2 weeks. What is Jesse going to do this fall? What part is he going to play in this campaign? Is he gone? And what if Dukakis should win? What is Dukakis going to do with Jackson after the election?
Ken, those were good questions. On your first question, you're absolutely correct. We've only really had good survey data since the 60s, really very good data since the 70s, but some data since the 60s. In looking at all the vice presidential candidates since 1960, there were really only two who made a real difference to their candidates. One was obviously Lyndon Johnson, who we think carried Texas for Kennedy. No one's completely sure, but at least the official tally showed that Kennedy and Johnson had in fact won Texas. The second instance that I think does relate, Fritz, to 1988 was in 1968. Now Hubert Humphrey didn't win, but his choice of Edmund Muskie actually did help him considerably. Of the four national candidates in 1968, that is the two vice presidential candidates and the two presidential candidates, the one with the highest popularity rating by far was vice presidential nominee Edmund Muskie on Hubert Humphrey's ticket. The lowest rated of the four by far was Spiro Agnew, who had thoroughly embarrassed himself and Richard Nixon during the campaign. It's very difficult to quantify what, in fact, what the difference was on election day. But Muskie brought so much favorable attention to Humphrey and also to his judgment in selecting Muskie. And Spiro Agnew brought problems for Richard Nixon and questions about his judgment that I think it may have helped Humphrey a bit and hurt Nixon a bit in 1968. In 1988, we'll just have to see. My guess is that, yes, the vice presidential candidates will fade into the background. Yes, without question, voters vote for president. They don't vote for vice president. There's no question about that. But I think they do interpret the presidential candidates in terms of their judgment. And their judgment, after all, is demonstrated first and most importantly in that choice of the vice presidential candidate. So if the Democrats choose to make this an issue and continue this theme as the Democrats in 1968 did, then I think it's possible that Quayle could subtract a point or two from Bush and that Benson could add a point or two to Dukakis. That's my guess at this early point. On your second question, I can say, you're right, you haven't heard much from Jesse Jackson the last 2 weeks, but this is the one prediction I feel absolutely confident in making. You will be hearing from Jesse Jackson. You'll be hearing a great deal from Jesse Jackson. The reason that I think Jackson has been relatively silent to this point is because he was very pleased with the deal that he got from Dukakis at the convention. And this has never been fully discussed and it's never become fully public. And no one knows what the details are. But from my discussions with some of the Dukakis people, I feel fairly certain that Jackson and Dukakis got down to brass tacks. They got down to the specifics in that Monday meeting. And I don't mean talking about Dukakis' commitment to civil rights. I mean talking about Dukakis' commitment to give Jesse Jackson a lot of resources during the campaign and major influence on positions after the campaign was over, assuming Dukakis was elected. I don't know whether Jesse Jackson will serve in a Dukakis administration, though my suspicion is that he will in some capacity.
I suspect that because of one thing. This year, what did people say about Jesse Jackson? They said he's not qualified to be president because he's never held a major governmental post. He's never shown that he can manage a major enterprise in the public sector. Forgetting about Push, which actually proves the opposite, given the mismanagement there. I think Jesse Jackson will want some kind of major position in order to prove for his next campaign, and he is the permanent campaign, for his next campaign, whether it's in 4 years or 8 years, that he has managed something and he hopes managed it well. So that's my guess. But at the very least, they discussed the sort of influence that Jackson would have on Dukakis, discussed how frequently Jackson would meet with Dukakis during his presidency, that sort of thing, and whether the Jackson people would be fully integrated into the Jackson into the Dukakis campaign and administration. So I think it got very specific, and I think Jackson is very pleased with the deal he got from Dukakis. And the Dukakis people are also very pleased because it hasn't become public for the most part.
There must be more than three crystal balls in the room. Who would like to begin by breaking some glass?
I was interested in the unfavorable comparison of Senator Quayle to Senator Glenn. Glenn has been on the federal payroll since he was 18 years old. Has a net worth of $7.5 million. Has a $2.5 million campaign debt from the presidency effort in 84, which he hasn't seen fit today. Seems to have a limited intellectual capability and did very poorly in the Democratic presidential campaign.
Why do I think so highly of him?
Yeah.
I don't personally, it's not my personal opinion. It's my interpretation of what will work electorally and what will move the most electoral votes into Michael Dukakis' column. You're certainly correct in pointing out the debt. His presidential campaign debt from 84 would have been a major problem. But your other point actually proves my point, which is you're claiming that his poor performance in the 84 Democratic primaries would mean that he wouldn't be a good national candidate. He didn't do well in the Democratic primaries in 84 because the Democratic Party electorate today is a very liberal electorate. It's disproportionately black, it's disproportionately labor union, it's disproportionately ideological liberals, and so on. Those are the people who participate in Democratic primaries, which frequently draw only 15% of the eligible voters. So it's a very liberal electorate. He didn't do well primarily because he was so moderate. The vast majority of the American electorate is clustered around the center. Some are a little bit to the left of center, and some are a little bit to the right of center, but 80% of all Americans are moderates, centrists, and pragmatists. And they're exactly the sort of people that John Glenn, all-American hero, space hero, military hero, all-American boy, they're exactly the sort of people that John Glenn appeals to. So that's why I said he would have made a better vice presidential candidate.
I'd like to ask a question that has possibly more to do with the process than it does the personality. In view of the Eagleton, Agnew, Quayle, Muskie controversies, the method of their selection and possible appointment qualify them to be president of the United States. I've been sometimes last-minute decision, as was the case in Quayle. Would the public interest be served by having a designation of the potential vice presidential candidate be made early enough so that discoveries, for instance, in the case of Quayle, they can discover that he's a pen-raised quail rather than a wild quail, which is really the bottom line of the weakness that is alleged to be found in.
Can you hear the questions in the outer room? Anybody want to repeat it?
Okay. I think the bottom line after that is, would you discuss the trade-offs for political maneuvering and advantages to be achieved by a late designation of a candidate rather than an earlier one, so that the electorate could be educated and that the press could have their field day?
I think the best rule for selecting vice presidential candidates, assuming the nominee has the luxury of time, and George Bush did, he had 5 months to make that decision. He had 5 months. But assuming the presidential candidate has the luxury of time, I think the rule is simply this. If the vice presidential candidate is going to be one of the other national candidates or someone who has run nationally before, you can afford to wait until relatively late in the process, because that individual has already undergone the scrutiny of the press and the public and the party officials and so on. So if Bush had been planning to name Bob Dole or Jack Kemp, he could have waited to the convention without any problems. But if the presidential candidate is planning to name someone who's relatively unknown, who hasn't been subjected to that scrutiny, the nominee, in his own interest, ought to name that candidate well in advance, so that if there is a problem, if a major problem develops, the change can be made before the formal ratification at the National Convention. The other suggestion that's been made over the years is that the presidential candidate ought not to make a choice at all at the presidential nominating convention, and rather ought to be given an additional month. And at the end of that month, the party's national committee should meet to ratify the candidate's choice. The idea there being that when candidates are still in the race for the presidency and that the nomination isn't decided until the convention, it doesn't happen anymore, but if that ever happened again, then the candidate would still have a month to make the choice. So I would favor either alternative, but I think it's in the candidate's own interest to do what George Bush didn't do, give people more time to investigate a little-known candidate so that he didn't end up with as much egg on his face as he's got on right now.
Your plan, though, those options, early or late, the way you have presented them, depends entirely upon a retrospective view. In other words, looking backwards as to whether the man has a public image or is known publicly.
No, not on Quayle.
In the case of Quayle now, what would have been the situation had Mr. Bush? Why wouldn't he? The press was pressing him, and as you indicated, there was months in there in which to make that determination. There must have been some strategic electoral process planning that he delayed. And he didn't delay it as long as he earlier expressed the intention of so doing. Was it to keep hopefuls back in it and support?
No, it was to preserve suspense for the convention. It was to try and build a television audience. It was a high price to pay for a TV audience. And by the way, he did succeed there. The final figures on the television audience showed that the Republican convention attracted, I think it was several tenths of a percent more of the viewing audience than did the Democratic convention. So he did get a higher audience, but as you rightly point out, it was a very high price to pay for that audience.
Next question. Professor Fernbach.
Larry, would you say a few words, please, about the coming debates, if they ever do come, and what you think may come out of them in terms of the political process?
We're in the midst of the debate. This happens every 4 years, about how many debates we're going to have and when they're going to be and who's going to sponsor them and so on. Dukakis wants 4 debates. The Bush people really would be happy with 1 debate. they'll compromise at either two or three. That's another firm prediction. They'll have either two or three debates, and the vice presidential candidates will have one debate. I think they'll probably have one in early to mid-October and one in very late October, the presidential candidates. Of course, debates are really as much about expectation games as anything else. The expectation is that if it's a foreign policy debate, Bush should do very well because he's got all the foreign policy experience and Michael Dukakis doesn't. The expectation also is that because Dukakis has had training as a television moderator and is very good on television, that he will project his personality better during the debates than George Bush will be able to. My guess is that both of the assumptions will be blown to pieces in the debates, that undoubtedly some commentators will say, my God, Michael Dukakis held his own on foreign policy with George Bush, and George Bush is supposed to be the expert. And others will say, my God, Michael Dukakis is supposed to be so good on television, and George Bush projected just as well and had just as many snappy one-liners as Michael Dukakis did. That will be the public comment. What really matters is how voters interpret those debates. And they interpret them both on the basis of what they see themselves on debate night for those who actually watch. And then they interpret them based on what the press tells them happened the day after the debate. And as you know, the press almost always seizes on one phrase or one sentence or one bad answer or one misstatement, and God only knows which candidate is going to be guilty of the misstatement. I couldn't tell you, but frankly, I'm sure their staffs are already nervous. They know that there's going to be a victim. They just don't know who the victim's going to be.
Will it be on Poland this time?
It may be Poland. It may be something else. Who knows?
Mrs.
Yemke
and then Mrs. Garland.
What do you think about the idea of submitting all the vice presidential names to the floor and have the delegates vote?
I think that's a question, in case you couldn't hear. What about the idea of submitting all the vice presidential names to the floor of the convention and letting the convention delegates vote on one? In theory, it sounds like a great idea. In practice, it could be a disaster, both because it would unleash emotions that the nominee might want kept pent up, and also because the nominee and his staff, presumably, Bush just violated this, but presumably they're in the best position to know who will make the best balance, who will produce the best balance on the ticket. So I tend to think that's a bad idea. It can produce an unbalanced ticket. It can unleash emotions that can be damaging to a party. And it also takes away a very important opportunity for the voters to test this potential president's judgment. So I prefer keeping it in the hands of the nominee, as undemocratic as that is.
Adlai Stevenson did that, you know.
Yeah, Adlai Stevenson did that in 56.
That's the way Jack Kennedy got permanent.
That's right. And in fact, he was very lucky that he lost.
Yeah.
He barely lost the nomination, and that saved him from condemnation after November and put him in a position to win the presidential nomination in 60.
Let's try to have three or four more pointed
exactly
questions. Henry and then Mrs. McGarner. Harry.
That was exactly the same question I had the other night. John Chancellor pointed out that it's the most ridiculous situation for one man in a democracy to appoint all by himself a man who potentially is going to become the president of the United States. Now, whether there's any alternative to that method, you already discussed that. I don't know whether it is or not.
Well, I've expressed my opinion on that. I favor the nominee. You know, the nominee, I think the president makes many important decisions, but the most important group of decisions any president makes is deciding who's going to hold high office, all the cabinet positions, the sub-cabinet positions, ambassadorial positions. I'd like to see one good case of a decision made ahead of the election. So that's why I favor, but I can understand your point of view on it. It is undemocratic, there's no question.
This is
the journalist George Bush
Well, it might depend on whether he has a dog. He does have a dog.
Of course.
How could that perfect family not have a dog? I don't know. I think we'll have to see how it develops. If this continues to percolate and boil away, then the Bush campaign will really face a very difficult choice. Either letting Quayle do something like that, letting try to save himself, as Nixon did in 52, or dropping from the ticket. And I think given that choice, they will choose to let him make a checkered speech. But they're convinced right now that they've turned the corner, that the worst is over, that the questions that are going to be answered have been answered. And they're very confident that the Quayle controversy has moved into another phase.
Mike, I want to ask another procedural question. With the vast and expensive and the amount of time we spent on primaries this year, are we going to get a better president, do you think? Should we go back to the old system of doing it a little more quickly?
Well, of course, many people argue for a return to a situation where party leaders had more power and influence. And I happen to favor increasing party influence, but I favor it through increasing superdelegates. Incidentally, the Democrats just went in the opposite direction. They caved into one of Jackson's demands and reduced drastically the number of superdelegates for the convention in 1992. I think they're moving in exactly the wrong direction. They ought to be increasing the number of superdelegates. I would not favor a return to... Super delegates are delegates that are not elected directly in the primaries. Rather, they're delegates that are automatically granted a vote at the convention by virtue of the office they hold. All members of the Democratic National Committee are super delegates, for example, and had a vote at the convention. Most of the members of Congress, all of the Democratic governors were super delegates, and so on and so forth. And this is a new development. It's just been in existence for a couple of election cycles.
Recommended by the Miller Center Commission on the Nominating Process.
That's right. Sorry, that's absolutely correct.
One or two final questions.
What I'm asking your research, how many votes are affected by television commercials?
The good news is that... that television commercials have relatively little impact on voters at the presidential level. And there's a good reason for this. Voters receive so many pieces of information that the television commercials add relatively little to their knowledge of the candidates, and also they're the most suspect pieces of information. They lack credibility because people know they're being sold something. Television commercials have a much greater impact for candidates, for Congress, House, and Senate, and so on, because they don't receive the same degree of media attention, free media attention, and therefore the voter needs to rely on the commercials to a much greater degree to find out basic facts about the candidates. So in a presidential election, I don't think they'll have nearly the impact that they will in the elections this year for House, Senate, and Governor.
One last question, Victor.
You raised a very interesting point, and I wasn't aware of it. The way the Democratic Party will pick the delegates in 92, aren't we going back over the McGovern-Minefield doing that?
We're going over what?
Another McGovern-Minefield doing that?
I don't know that I want to touch that one. I think they've moved in a wrong direction. The Dukakis people will tell you privately that obviously, if he's elected, it won't matter anyway. And they're right. Assuming he doesn't get into deep trouble in his first term, he'll be easily renominated, won't have to worry about superdelegates or regular delegates. They also say that given that breathing space, they plan to reverse that decision later on when it doesn't matter. Whether they do or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I do think they've moved in the wrong direction, and I do hope they reverse it at some point. If Dukakis loses, then they've left the Democratic Party a rather sad legacy in that respect.
Yeah. One final.
I'd like to ask a follow-up on my earlier question. The about Jackson. He said we were going to hear a lot from Jackson. You don't think that Jackson and Dukakis agreed what Jackson might and might not do this fall? Because it seems to me that the more Jackson talks, the more it's going to hurt Dukakis. I mean, he might have agreed that he wouldn't make any outstanding speeches which are critical of the moderate position, as he did during the primary.
I think that's probable. I'm sure they discussed what Jackson would do, and of course they're providing him the campaign plane and staff and so on to push voter registration. But people like Jesse Jackson, and I don't want to include other preachers in here, but I think it may be appropriate, because I've noticed this with Jerry Falwell, with Pat Robertson and others. What they say they will do, and then what they actually do, sometimes are very different, because they can't quite resist. You remember Jerry Falwell said he was going to get out of politics? He was going to stay out of politics? Well, for the 4 days of the Republican convention, I saw Jerry Falwell roaming the floor, conducting every interview he could get his hands on. I just don't know that Jackson will be able to resist a few shots somewhere along the line between now and November. But I agree with you. I think they'll be minimal, because Jackson, it's in his interest to see Dukakis elected, and it's in his interest to fulfill the bargain he's made with Dukakis.
But the more he talks, the more it's going to hurt Dukakis, I think.
You're right.
Larry Sabato has proven today that some prophets are honored in their own community and their own society.
You didn't take a poll, kid.
When we came here, there used to be one of our colleagues, Bob Harris, who would always tell us the story about Larry Sabato and the Vietnam War. Students were highly critical of government policy, and so was Larry up to a point, but he also was a great balance wheel in the discussion that made people think about all aspects of the problem, according to Harris. We miss Bob Harris. Fortunately, we haven't had to miss Larry Sabato, and we hope this will be one of many discussions that we can have with him at the Miller Center, because he is a priceless resource in this community. Thank you very much.